From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
This week, the country witnessed their leader's reluctance to full-throatedly rebuke Nazis and Klansmen, so we will discuss the damage Donald Trump visited upon himself with his handling of the Charlottesville protests. Also, we'll ask, with the dissolution of two presidential business councils, is there a chance for Republicans in any way to advance their economic agenda? And finally, should we remove symbols of the Confederacy and how? And we'll go one-on-one with a former FBI agent who infiltrated white supremacist groups and went on to work with the ACLU. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Mike Pesca, sitting in for Josh Barrow. That's all up ahead. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm your guest host, Mike Pesca, from the Slate podcast, The Gist. I am sitting in for Josh Barrow. On the left is Jameel Smith, political journalist and contributing writer at The Daily Beast. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And our special guest is Kelly Goff. She's a columnist at The Daily Beast. Welcome to you all. Since there was last a Left, Right, and Center broadcast or podcast, a fascistic protest in Charlottesville, Virginia turned ugly and then deadly. In reacting to the events, Donald Trump failed to call out Nazis and the KKK specifically. He blamed misdeeds on many sides. 2 days later, he read prepared remarks, which finally did name the groups and called for, quote, every citizen in this blessed land to be free to follow their dreams. Then the next day at Trump Tower, he said, but really, there was blame on many sides. Every week, it seems that the president does very little to advance his agenda and much to get in his own way. This week was worse than usual. It seems, in fact, to have cost Steve Bannon his job at the time of taping. It was reported that the president's chief strategist was out. That has not yet been made official. Jameel, I'll give you a second to note the sheer immorality of everything that went on with Charlottesville, but I want to ask a political question, which is, did he get anything out of it strategically?
No, I don't think he gained a thing. I think what he did was, perhaps calcified the part of the base that was already very much with him, very much willing to, you know, accept any of his faults as long as he keeps doing the work of white supremacy for them. And that is really all that matters. What he says, while hurtful and certainly unpresidential, didn't really matter as much as his willingness to show to them that he's willing to continue working towards their objectives.
Kelly, it's been said so many times, well, what did you expect? He told us who he was during the campaign, and this is just him showing his stripes. Was that your reaction?
Well, I will tell you this much. That was my personal reaction, but what has been really interesting and what I've been keeping an eye on more so is the reaction of people I know who voted for him. I have to tell you that I had conversations this week, including, you know, with a particularly prominent conservative, who said, I just really didn't see this coming, especially the performance on Tuesday. And what I mean by that is there were people who thought, he's crass. We get it. That's who he is. That's not something to be particularly proud of. But I literally had a conversation with this conservative about 9 months ago about the impact the Donald Trump candidacy was having on white supremacists. Specifically, if you chart the numbers and follow the Southern Poverty Law Center's data, you saw white supremacist groups really peaked under President Obama's first term. By his second term, those numbers started to nosedive. And one of the theories I'd heard is that some of them kind of gave up. And you'd think, well, why wouldn't they? You have mixed race families being among the fastest growing demographics in this country. You had two terms of an African-American president. And then Donald Trump started to run and we started to see those numbers tick back up. So people like me, you know, someone who's African-American and covering this stuff, was absolutely concerned. But I definitely knew of people, particularly white conservatives, who said literally verbatim to me, oh, Kelly, that's maybe a half dozen people, if that, who are actually putting on, you know, Klan robes and waving Nazi flags. I mean, come on, Kelly, that's not where we're at. You know, the people being called racist are people who simply want to see illegal immigrants deported. That's not racist. The people you're talking about with these Klan robes. And now we saw, you know, Charlottesville really opened the eyes of a lot of people. And that's who I've been hearing from this week, is people saying, oh, my God, I had no idea that it was still this bad. And I actually think that's a win for America, because once you acknowledge how bad things are, you can start to really work on improving things.
Well, Kelly just mentioned a prominent conservative. Rich, you are one. Were your eyes open to anything?
Well, I did hope that the weight of the office and the responsibility would have some effect on Donald Trump, despite his rather obvious character flaws. And it didn't. He hasn't changed in the least. And we've talked about this in the program over the months. You know, I thought there'd be an ideological challenge from Donald Trump. You know, his populism would take forms that would be at odds with conservative orthodoxy. There'd be a big trillion-dollar infrastructure bill out of the gate or something like that. None of that's happened. It's been a characterological challenge, and we saw it most clearly this week. And, you know, he had a moment where he could have risen to the occasion. He could have hid his flaws. He just could have read at least from a teleprompter and left it at that. And he couldn't. And I think, for me, it seems the explanation is that he realizes from his time as birther, from the campaign where all these various trolls and bots and conspiracy theorists and various haters provided him a lot of social media air cover, he realizes that there's political energy in the fever swamp. So he doesn't anymore want to be in with those people with both feet, but he doesn't want to go out of his way to alienate them. So that was why we saw, you know, the initial reaction where he was strategically ambiguous. Then when that was unsustainable, the statement Tuesday, which I thought was strong and completely appropriate, you would expect to hear from a president and hear from a president immediately, but it didn't sit well for him. And he went back Tuesday, and a lot of people say the Tuesday press conference reverted to Saturday. No, it didn't. It was worse, because Saturday was ambiguous. Tuesday, he actually said they were fine people marching alongside people carrying Nazi flags. He praised this torch-lit Nazi march on the grounds of the University of Virginia on Friday night. And that's just completely shocking and outrageous.
Yeah, another worst thing about the Tuesday press conference was he went back and said, well, on that first day press conference, the facts weren't in. But then if you thought for a second, you said, okay, so then the next day when the facts were in and you gave your statement, what you're doing today is contradicting your statement from when the facts were in. You were essentially telling everyone, listen to the first day's press conference where I said there was fault on many sides. Oh, yes, and we'll also add to this that there were some good people among the protests. That can't be the case. Good people do not stand shoulder to shoulder with tiki torch wearing Nazis, even if you believe in some version of heritage and hate. Right, Jamil?
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. The very baseline for any president, any really human being, should be don't defend Nazis, don't defend white supremacists, don't defend, more specifically, a murderer. I mean, let's not forget, yeah, like the fact that a murder happened at this protest, it's really a demonstration. The fact that a murder happened there changes the entire tone of this. Okay, we had someone using the tactics of international terrorism right here at home. We had then a president who normally condemns such terrorist acts, refusing to even not only recognize the fact that it was terrorism, but that something wrong had happened. In fact, blaming the other side for, you know, provoking the violence. It's absolutely insane that a president of, you know, any character would choose to do this. It illustrated once again the wide gulf between his character and that which we should expect from a president. I mean, he's derelict in his public duty as a public servant by ignoring the public danger of the statues in the first place. We now see that they're now a gathering place for evil. And he's saying that we should keep these statues because they're beautiful and historic and preserve culture. But in fact, you know, look, they're a gathering place for people who commit terrorist acts. Don't you think that a president should be addressing that?
Yeah, and Kelly, what Jamil was saying, put aside the moral failings politically, you know, Jamil just responded to decrying Nazis as at least a baseline. I also think it's something of a gift, because even someone who opposes all of the issues of progressivism as it deals with race, and someone who looks at the prison industrial complex and says something like, yeah, that's good, that person at least will say, yeah, but Nazis are bad. I mean, look at Jeff Sessions' career and everything he's ever done, but this guy still prosecutes Klansmen. So you still have that out of saying, I'm not a real racist, I'm against the Klansmen and the Nazis, and Donald Trump didn't even take that opportunity.
Well, yeah, I mean, I want to say two things. What was funny is David Duke, you know, had the temerity to thank the president for his remarks. And if anyone should be thanking him, it should be people who don't support having the statues issues in public places, because it's now been expedited how quickly they're being removed, and people are introducing bills to have them removed. I mean, in Baltimore, they'd passed the legislation to have them removed, but they decided to go ahead and do it overnight because of Charlottesville. So if anything, he's actually helped people who oppose the statues in record time in a way that they could not have been helped had he not made his incredibly embarrassing remarks. But I would say that you know, you raised a really important point, which is there was certainly a lot of racism, legitimate racism, during the Obama era. I mean, there were so many inappropriate racist comments made, particularly by Republican elected officials, including the watermelon patch jokes around the White House and all sorts of things, that New York Magazine actually put together a slideshow. That's how many there were in his first year. And yet what ended up happening is you started to see this divide where someone would say something legitimately racist, they'd get called out. But then someone would state a policy position that someone on the left didn't like, and they'd also be called racist. If you want to deport mm-hmm. someone who's here illegally, you're a racist. And what that did is that neutralized the argument. And then over the remainder of the Obama era, you start to see people say, oh, they're throwing around the R word again, and just shut down. And what I actually think Donald Trump's behavior has done is helped reset the conversation, where people are forced to acknowledge that, okay, there actually is a real serious problem with race in this country. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about it in a way we weren't even willing to talk about it at the end of the Obama era. And so for that, President Trump has actually, I think, helped advance the conversation around race in this country in a meaningful way, and in a way he didn't want to.
Steve Bannon said in his interview with Robert Kuttner, and he said this before, I want to have this discussion about race. It's a winner for Republicans. It shows that the Democrats are involved in identity politics. Well, maybe that was true a few weeks ago when the conversation on race was the stuff that, you know, Kelly was talking about. When the conversation on race is about Nazis, I don't know if that's a winner for Republicans. In fact, I know it's not.
Well, my advice to my friends on the left would be twofold. One, outfits like the Southern Poverty Law Center, they call you a hate group if you oppose high levels of immigration. They call you a hate group if you oppose gay marriage. And now that we see that there are real neo-Nazis out there, not a lot. You know, this was more than the average Nazi rally, which is, as far as back as I can remember, is usually involves like half a dozen people with droopy Nazi flags. You know, there are a couple of hundred or hundreds. But it's still a national rally, and that's not a big outpouring. But these people should be focused on, they should be denounced, but the word should be reserved for people who are actually racist. Two, the way that Trump said both sides were to blame was objectionable. It didn't make important distinctions. The Nazis were the proximate cause of this event because it was their idiot march that started it. They were interested in violence. They had a murderer in their midst, and in any contest over whom is the most loathsome people in the planet, the Nazis are going to win. But yes, there are some peaceful peaceful counter protesters, but there are also these Antifa thugs who are thugs, who thrill to violence, who wear black clothes, who wear masks, who were eager to fight with the Nazis. And people of goodwill on both sides should denounce violence on both sides. And my fear is that the way Trump's handled this gives permission to supporters to try to find excuses for some of these people who are marching down in Charlottesville. But on the other side, I fear the way Trump's handled it is pushing the left into evading or making excuses for violent thugs on their side.
All right. Well, let us know what you think about everything that's gone on surrounding Charlottesville. Up ahead, more on what's been going on this week. We'll look at the business angles and how Republicans will react. You are listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Mike Pesca, host of the Slate podcast, The Gist, standing in for Josh Barrow. On the left is political journalist Jamil Smith. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and our special guest is Kelly Goff, columnist at The Daily Beast. So perhaps in the same vein that someone says, oh, wasn't that play called Our American Cousin? A future generation will say, actually, wasn't that press conference supposed to be about infrastructure? Yes, that will be forgotten too. But what's important is that members of the president's manufacturing council defected. That council was disbanded. And then members of the strategy and political forum did the same. Now, look, Rich, I'll acknowledge that the end of these two councils, not the end of the world. They don't undo all the work that Donald Trump has put in to his economic agenda. But when you think about it, what work has he really put down in his economic agenda?
Well, I don't think these councils are particularly important in their own right. Obviously, they have some marginal utility because everyone has them. So to that extent, maybe it hurts Trump at the margin. But I think just speaks to a larger collapse of elite support for Trump. Not that there's a lot of it to begin with. And his supporters will say, well, he won the election without the support of elites, which was true. But it helps to have corporate titans at least willing to sit around the table with you. It helps to have a journal that is purports to be high-minded, like this journal called American Affairs that was actually founded to support Trump. Its editor came out this week and said, I regret voting for the guy. So that is something significant that's happened this week. It's not going to collapse his presidency. It's not the end of the agenda necessarily, but it doesn't help.
You know, something to be mindful of is we've seen this more than once, which is just because someone can run a winning campaign doesn't mean they can run a winning administration. And I would say, for instance, in the case of President Obama, he had a number of wins. He probably would have had more if he had the Bill Clinton gene, where he was actually interested in watching football with someone who said something terrible about him the day before. And, you know, by all accounts, that wasn't something he was interested in doing. And maybe there were a couple more wins he could have gotten out of that. In Donald Trump's case, he's incapable of working with anyone, because anyone who has ever said anything critical of him is not welcome, right? So that's going to make it a little hard for him to get anything done with politicians or with business leaders or with pretty much anyone on the planet. Because at this point, I mean, I think Fox News was just mentioning that they couldn't even book anyone from the Republican Congress to discuss Charlottesville after Tuesday because no one wanted to defend him. So I think the larger concern about these councils is what it says about his ability to actually govern, and not just in the political terminology, but to actually get anything accomplished. The last thing I would say, too, is, you know, I think we should be less concerned about these councils, which are a little bit for show and for press conferences and that sort of thing, and more concerned about what happens if capable, competent people start fleeing the White House. Because Gary Cohen, I wouldn't be surprised if he played some role in Bannon's ultimate departure, because by all accounts, while Gary Cohen has not said he's walking out the door, it's a possibility. If he leaves and other people like him who actually have some knowledge and competence start walking out the door, then frankly, everything falls apart even more so than it already has.
You know, I agree with that with the generals. I wonder, like, why does Gary Cohen have to be there? If he's not going to get an agenda, I mean, you could say cynically because he wants to be appointed chairman of the Fed. But it's not like he's standing between Trump and Armageddon, like perhaps Mattis and McMaster is. Jamil, what do you think?
Well, I mean, just pivot real quick back to the CEO thing. I mean, I think we can all agree that the manner in which Trump dissolved the council was reminiscent of a high school kid telling the girl dumping him that he's actually breaking up with her. It's really childish. But the significance of the CEO defection to me is that it's a form of resistance that Republicans may actually give credence to. Now, they aren't listening to the folks who are shouting about keeping Obamacare at town halls, clearly. They're not listening to Black Lives Matter protesters. They'll listen to the money. And when they see corporate America rejecting Trump, and they, you know, they recognize that they too can take the president's Twitter harassment afterwards, perhaps not. Maybe they'll start to condemn Trump in tweets and whatnot, and maybe they'll also work actively to isolate and resist him themselves through policy.
Rich, do you think that's what really is going on, or are the CEOs know enough to know the heat's on now? Let's just step into the sidelines for a second. Maybe we'll come back when it's needed.
I don't think they're coming back any time soon unless there's some significant event that allows Trump to reset. And in terms of congressional Republicans, they're privately appalled by Trump, most of them. And you've seen some public indication of it, mostly with statements that clearly are kind of passive-aggressively aimed at Trump without naming him. But you've seen, you know, Lindsey Graham and Bob Corker being a little more explicit, but I wouldn't expect to see a real split with congressional Republicans until the beginning of next year, because I think the legislative string needs to play out. They need to see whether they can possibly revive a healthcare bill. They need to see whether they can do anything on taxes. And, you know, by the beginning of next year, we'll know the answer on that. And then nothing else is going to happen, even if nothing more is going to happen at the beginning of next year. And then kind of the legislative glue will give way. And you've already seen, you know, Trump shooting at some of these guys, as I say, privately, they kind of disdain him. And that's when I think we could see a very ugly divorce between the president and the congressional party.
Can I just jump in, though, and say that even out here in California, you know, you have Congressman Daryl Issa, who has just announced that he believes there should be an investigation into white supremacy groups at the home in terms of the Homeland Security Committee and the Judiciary Committee. And now he's considered one of the more vulnerable congressional Republicans heading into midterms. But I think as more polling starts to indicate that there are people who were appalled by this president, even people who voted for him, we're going to start to see a bit of a sea change. Because the idea of someone like Ted Cruz saying he believes there should be, you know, a Justice Department investigation was not something that if you had bet me $1 million a year ago, I would have said I'd ever see happen. So I think, again, we should be watching and waiting, because I wouldn't be so sure that all of them are going to kind of be willing to stick it out with him. I think that that remains to be seen.
Yeah, Daryl Issa was elected by one of the slimmest margins. That probably has more to do with the makeup Absolutely. Of his district than anything else. But the way I see it is that the Republicans in the Congress said, well, Trump's president, that's good. It'll give us a chance to pass our agenda. Now they're saying, Trump's president, that's bad. Get out of the way. So at least we have the chance to pass our agenda. They still want to pass our agenda. I don't know if any of the people, Bob Corker, who has question the president's competence or his stability. I don't know if he turns into a no vote, or if any of these Republicans turn into a no vote on tax reform. Jamil?
Yeah, until Republicans become less afraid of Trump's voters than they are of anything else, then nothing will change. We're dealing with an agenda, Republican agenda, that serves to buttress the very aims of not just the people who marched with torches on, you know, University of Virginia campus, not just the people who were in Charlottesville on Saturday, but also people who are, you know, a lot more quiet about it. They won't march. They won't say that they're Nazis or white supremacists, but they'll advocate for the very same policies that serve the aims of white supremacy. And so until Republicans make a serious break with those agenda items and actually start to vote no on those agenda items, I won't believe that they're going to do anything more than send a tweet that has a few keywords in it and sounds mildly condemning.
But the thing is, again, I want to be careful here, because I think this would actually prove Bannon's comments to the American Prospect to be right. I think that if people on the left play into this idea that any person who agrees with Donald Trump on anything, whether it's an economic policy issue or anything else, is by very definition a racist, I think that Bannon's right.
That's not what I'm saying.
Okay, that you know, they lose next election cycle. I think even, again, if people decide to define racist voting very broadly from a policy standpoint, I think it's problematic. I think this is actually a real opening for people who actually care again about specific policy issues and moving the conversation forward in this country. I think there's an opportunity to do that, because there are people who are listening, but they're not going to listen if the message becomes, if you are by definition of a Republican, that you are a racist. And I think that's what Bannon was talking about in that American Prospect interview by saying, you know, I want the left to keep talking about identity politics. I never bought the idea that it was the fault of oppressed groups that Hillary Clinton lost the last election. What I did buy into was the idea that coverage of a lot of those issues actually helped cost Hillary Clinton the election. Because while a white unemployed factory worker was trying to figure out how to send his kid to college, all he kept seeing was Caitlyn Jenner on the cover of magazines and conversations from people at elite universities about safe spaces, when there were larger issues that unite all of us in terms of economic inequality that should have been getting more credit, coverage and attention. So I hope that there is an opportunity again to press reset in how we see that there is more that unites us in this country than divides us. I think that's what I'm hoping comes out of Charlottesville.
Also, I mean, you can disagree with the idea of cutting marginal tax rates, but it has nothing to do with white supremacy.
Sure, it
you
does.
Can. what is tax reform? Like, the 1986 tax reform was a great white supremist initiative.
Okay, here's what's not absurd. Okay. The fact that economics and race identity, all these gender, you know, various things have to deal with the things that, you know, you think are just purely, you know, about fiduciary matters. All right. Here's the point. It's not about whether or not people are racist. It's not about whether or not they're white supremacists themselves or have that feeling in their heart. It's not about what we see as racism. You know, we see a lot of people in polos and khakis holding tiki torches. It's not about whether or not they're dressed as racist or behaving in a racist manner. It's about whether or not the end product of the policy that they are advocating serves to disadvantage and create a further divide between whites and other non-whites in this country.
I don't think the goons with the tiki torches care about marginal tax rates.
They voted for it.
A 20% tax rate is racist, whereas a 50% top tax rate isn't. I mean,
if you want to pick out taxes as one issue, that's fine. But you can also talk about immigration. You can talk about abortion.
The agenda
includes a lot of things, Rich.
The Cotton-Purdue bill would diversify our immigration flow. That's racist?
Listen, again, you're misinterpreting my point almost, it seems like willingly. My point
It's what you said.
No, Rich, it's not what I said. I said the point isn't about whether or not it's racist. The point is that whether or not these particular agenda items serve to buttress the goals of white supremacy. If you're unwilling to recognize...
So tax reform is a white supremacist policy because it furthers the goal of white supremacy. That's what you're saying.
And I'm saying...
I really urge you to attack the white supremacist and not broadly...
I'd urge you to work on the problem of white supremacy and not tell me how to address a particular problem.
Well, I don't think... everyone who favors a different tax system, those aren't racist or white supremacist.
You to maybe prioritize the actually fixing the problems that feed racial inequality in this country and not worry about how people are feeling, especially white supremacists.
Kelly, go ahead. Take the last word.
One of the things that drives me insane is you see, poor white Americans who march and say, okay, there are more minorities going to Harvard. This means we have to be against affirmative action because those poor minorities are taking our slots. And then you have some minority students at places like Harvard who are saying, we have to get rid of white supremacy. And then you have some poor unemployed person who can't afford to go to Harvard who's sitting there watching that. And in the meantime, you have someone who's like a third or fourth generation member of the Bush family or someone who's just has no problem gliding into a place like Harvard. And the people who are working class of all races are struggling. And so what I would love to see actually happen is for us to have that conversation is, again, about what unites us across racial lines and party lines and the real substantive issues of the people who are controlling this country. And those people are people who are members of the financial elite.
I agree. We can all get behind the fact that the Bushes are taking our spots at Harvard. And I urge you, our listeners, to let us know what you think about all this on our Facebook page or our Twitter account at LRCKCRW. Back to our third topic. So obviously, President Trump took the heat for so many days. He was trying desperately to change the subject, and he started tweeting about the advisability of taking down statues of Confederates. He said, what's next? He engaged with the slippery slope. What's next, George Washington? But then across the country, we saw in Durham, North Carolina, the citizens taking down the statues. In Baltimore, the mayor ordered the statues down legally by decree. So let's talk about this and how we grapple with our past at the risk of even playing into the president's game of changing the topic. And also, let's note, maybe we could spend a moment or two here, that so much of this has been pushed to the fore by the alt-right, which was emboldened and practically defined by Steve Bannon when he was a Breitbart. He has reportedly been asked to leave the White House. So, Kelly, do you see a difference between taking down statues in Baltimore, taking down statues in Durham, what they were doing in Charlottesville? Do you parse that? How do you parse all that?
Well, first of all, I think there's a place in this world for all sorts of things that a wide swath of people find offensive, and those places are usually called libraries and museums. I think that, Jeb Bush took down the Confederate flag above the State House in Florida almost 15 years ago, and there was not a big hullabaloo. I think it was moved to a museum. Look, I will say that, there are certain people, if you're talking about George Washington, who was a slave owner, or Thomas Jefferson, who was a slave-owning rapist. And I want to just say for the record, the last time I called him a rapist on this very show, I received angry letters from your listeners. So I want to clarify, I'm not sure what you call someone who impregnates a teenager that he owns. But there are, cities and universities named after Washington and Jefferson. So I do think that there is room to have a conversation about how we calibrate this. I know that Ole Miss, for instance, is erecting a plaque that clarifies, slavery was the root of the Civil War, and they're going to put that by their Confederate museum. But I just want to say that there are, I think, over 1,500 Confederate flags, symbols, monuments throughout the U.S. But guess what? 1 in 10 of them were erected after 1950. So just think about that. At the height of the civil rights movement, to scare away people like my mother, who was living in the South and was, you know, was the first class to integrate her high school. That's why those were erected. I think those need to go. And I think that there is no decent person who would defend someone saying, I'm going to, in 1955, put up a Confederate battle flag to scare away people who are marching for equality. I don't think that's an unreasonable request at all, even if you're a history buff.
Rich?
Yeah, I would say a couple things. One, mob action is wrong, and what happened in Durham, North Carolina, was a disgrace. This is a process that should proceed lawfully and democratically. The states and localities that have authority over these things should deliberate carefully about what to do with them. And my suggestion would be there are certain statues that just should be trashed. I mean, there's no case for having a statue of Jefferson Davis, the incompetent president of the Confederacy, or Roger Taney, who had two statues in the state of Maryland, not a Confederate, but one of the most execrable figures from the history of the Civil War. Now, I think, you know, a Robert E. Lee is a different proposition. And the way I look at it is we want to be clear, and this goes to some of the history of the statue of these statues that and symbols that Kelly referred to, that we're not in any way valorizing or glorifying or romanticizing or prettying up the cause of the Confederacy. We don't want to do that. We do because this was an American tragedy and there are Americans fighting on both sides. We do want to memorialize the sacrifice, and in some cases the valor, of the other side that was desperately mistaken, but they're still Americans. So that's why I would take these statues of Lee, I'd put them in cemeteries, I'd put them in battlefields. I think the city commission in Baltimore had a really good proposal on the statue they had of Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee. The statue was of their last meeting in Chancellorsville. That statue should go to the Chancellorsville battlefield. To me, that would be entirely appropriate. And I do, one thing I think Trump is completely right about, there is a slippery slope here. And we're so inflamed, there's such a moral panic over statues and memorials. You do have people on the left talking about taking down commemorations and markers and ways to honor men like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, and that would be a shame.
My two cents is this. I think that there's a better case for honoring the execrable Roger Taney who made the Dred Scott decision, because at least that guy wasn't a traitor and treasonous like the very bold and valorous Robert E. Lee was. If you want to talk slippery slopes, how about no statues of people who are traitors against the country in which you're putting the statue up? Jamil, I'll give you the last word on this.
Yeah, all the concern trolling about erasing history is really problematic to me. I think what we need to do is, frankly, is melt them all down. I think what we've done here is, basically serve to obscure the actual history of the Civil War, helped Americans to understand it less, not more. And also, letting these monuments to essentially terrorism against African Americans remain standing in town squares. I don't think that there's any reason to honor a slaveholder, not just a slaveholder, but a man who led an army specifically for the purposes of maintaining his right to enslave in any kind of public square. If you need to learn about Robert E. Lee, you can go read a book about him.
You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. I am your guest host, Mike Pesca, and I've been talking with political journalist Jamil Smith, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast. We're going to come back and speak with an expert on extremist groups. You are listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your guest host, Mike Pesca of the Slate podcast, The Gist. We are going to welcome a new guest to the panel now. Mike German is a former FBI agent who went undercover with neo-Nazis and white supremacist groups. He is now a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, Liberty, and National Security. And Mike, before we start with the questioning, I would like to play a clip from Saturday Night Live. This is Tina Fey. I think the clip illustrates a little of the new awareness of militias and nationalist groups. Here is Tina Fey suggesting everyone should eat an American flag sheet cake to address their anxiety.
But the other side is Nazis and Klansmen. And also, who drove the car into the crowd? Hillary's emails?
Well, you know, they've already canceled some of these new rallies.
You see, it's working already. Sheet caking is a grassroots movement, Colin. Most of the women I know have been doing it once a week since the election. And don't worry, guys, by the way, don't worry. Some of the people in Charlottesville weren't Klansmen. They were independent militias. Did you know there's over 250 well-armed militias across the U.S. that are ready to mobilize at any time? No. And guess what, Shay? They're not cops. No. They're not cops, Shay. They're just militias, and they train themselves.
Give me some of that damn cake, man.
Mike German, short of stuffing ourselves with sheet cake, and maybe that'll help, how worried should we be about white supremacists, militias, everything Tina Fey was talking about?
I think it's important to understand how these groups influence our policies and understand how the violent fringes of these groups can be dangerous to our security and the security of all American communities.
And so lay that out.
This is really much more complex than most people assume. We think of these ideas as radical and extreme and unusual, but you have to understand that these ideas have been around for a long, long time, right? These ideas, when Europeans decided to colonialize the world, they had all sorts of theologies and philosophies and ideologies that justified white domination of people of color, right? So all the way through the slave era, all the way through Jim Crow and civil rights, the immigration policies that were very anti-Asian, the internment of the Japanese, these were all mainstream people and government entities, and they had a number of ideologies, philosophies, and theologies. A lot of this was theological in nature that justified it. And those ideas never went away. They were mainstream, and they simply were pushed to the margins through the civil rights era. But vestiges of that openly racist past still exist, right? We still have structural inequality in all aspects of American life. You know, whether you're talking about who sits on corporate boards, whether you're talking about who sits in government agencies, the FBI, the organization I worked for, is still more than 83% white. So, you know, when we talk about these groups, you know, we have to understand how they influence policy. Now, that's a different problem than the violent fringe. And, you know, the violent fringe has been a persistent problem in the United States. Luckily, it's a low-level problem. I mean, certainly in terms of terrorism, far-right terrorism kills more Americans in the average year, with few exceptions, than any other kind. In fact, than all other kinds together. So, you know, to the extent we're concerned about terrorism in this country, we should be putting more than half of those resources towards this threat. But we don't. In general, I think the police do a good job of policing these, including the FBI. You know, they do proactive investigations like my undercover operations. They do take the threat seriously. When a crime does occur, they devote resources to it and usually solve those cases very quickly. And there are plenty of criminal laws to ensure that they're punished adequately. So up until 6 months ago, I would have said, you know, this is something that police do well because they address the problem without amplifying the public fear of it, right? Because that's what these violent people want to do, is they want to make people afraid and influence policy through fear and intimidation. So when the government says this problem is bigger than it is, much the way they do with ISIS terrorism or Al-Qaeda terrorism, they're actually giving the groups more power. So I would have argued that policing in the United States of these groups is actually done well. But that was before this series of protests, and Charlottesville was just the latest of them. Going back to last year, there was a protest in Sacramento where white supremacist groups went to rally, and there was violence and reports that the police were standing back and not intervening. And I, I really didn't pay much attention to it. I just assumed that mm-hmm. that was kind of a one-off case where the police weren't ready for what happened. But then we saw two in Berkeley in March and April, another one in Bolsa Chica State Beach in Huntington Beach, California. In Portland, Oregon, Department of Homeland Security law enforcement officers allowed the militia to assist them in arresting a counter-protester. So that kind of reaction to a protest is very different from what we've seen in protests, in other protests, like the Standing Rock protests, where the groups weren't going there openly saying that they were going intending to commit violence. The Ferguson protests, you just look at the Occupy movement. Again, a completely nonviolent movement was aggressively policed. And even the anti-Trump rally in D.C. after the inauguration, the police used incredibly aggressive methods, used kettling techniques, and arrested 200 people and charged them with felonies. Because some windows got broken and a limousine got torched. And those are crimes, and certainly there should be enforcement of those crimes. But if you arrest 200 people on felonies for breaking windows, I don't understand how these protests, where the reporters are able to get up and identify who are the people who are committing these violent acts, but somehow the response is very different. And that's troubling to me. And I'm not sure I can understand it.
Okay, it seems to me that there can be a couple things going on. First of all, Donald Trump and his former right-hand man, Steve Bannon, has certainly emboldened these groups. So does that mean they've gotten more virulent and are scarier to the police? Or are you saying or seeing signs that the police have been either told explicitly or the messages back off and give them more space than we formerly would have? Both things could be going on at the same time, by the way.
Right. And like I said, this is kind of a two-track thing, right? And while there is violence coming out of these communities that I'm very concerned about, I'm actually more concerned about white supremacists and white supremacist ideology actually influencing our immigration policy and economic policies and other policies than I am about the violence. You know, these are two separate issues. So Donald Trump appealing to these groups through his candidacy and then bringing on people who have established a platform for their views like Steve Bannon or Steve Miller or Sebastian Gorka into the White House, I think is troubling because it gives them influence on policy. And we've seen those policies, right? The aggressive enforcement of immigration in Latino communities, the Muslim travel ban, rhetoric telling police to be rougher with communities. You know, these are things that are going to harm many more people because it's actually part of government policy. You know, when we've seen white supremacists take over governments, they do much more damage than fringe groups do. So. I'm very concerned about that part of it, but I'm not sure I understand this inadequate policing on the protest side. But the fact that it's happening in a short period of time over a broad geographic area where at the same time they're aggressively policing other protests, I think there needs to be an explanation, and I think it's up to the state and local governments because I'm not sure that the Jeff Sessions Justice Department is willing to aggressively look into it.
Okay, but it does seem to me that there are political legislative fixes for everything you were laying out with possible policy prescriptions that are driven by white supremacist groups. I'm worrying right now in this question, at least, about the possibility of violence, terrorism directly from those groups. And there's a paradox. Help me navigate it. On the one hand, you're saying that they're dangerous and they're perhaps more dangerous than we ever realized. But on the other hand, you yourself said to believe in how dangerous they are, or at least to get very concerned about that, might be exactly playing into what they want. So what should we do?
So I think the first question or the first answer is breaking down who they is, right? They isn't everyone who has white supremacist ideas. You know, they're like I said, corporate boardrooms are overwhelmingly white. I'm not sure that that's an accident, right? So there is racism throughout our society. You know, our criminal justice system disproportionately impacts people of color. So, you know, what we have to distinguish between is, you know, with these extremist groups, there's two sides of it, right? There's an above ground ideological side that writes papers and publishes books and has websites and organizes rallies and does these things, and all that's not going to hurt anybody, right? It's abhorrent. There's nobody who hates these ideas more than I do, because I had to spend a lot of time with them listening to these ideas. But the violent fringe is actually has been an arm's length distance from that part of the movement, right? And this is sometimes tactical, right? If you're going to be a well-known leader of a white supremacist group that wants to put your message forward, and you want to be, you know, the media darling that gets all the microphones put in front of you, the last thing you want to be doing is conspiring to commit crimes, because that's going to make it very easy to arrest you. So part of it's tactical. Part of it is actually a decision. You know, many of the people that I met, I was a criminal within this organization when I was undercover, you know, they would try to talk me out of engaging with the criminal side of the movement. They would say, you know, that's going to make us look bad. You know, we can win by expressing our ideas. You know, come over to our side and write newsletters. You know, you're a young person with no tattoos. We can run you for office. You know, we can do all these things. So they really believed that violence wasn't the way to accomplish their goals. So you have to understand what we're talking about. The violence that we're talking about is specific fringe. That's a minority of these groups, which is a good thing. That makes it easier, right? We can focus our efforts where there's evidence that somebody is actually committing a crime. And that's how my investigations worked. And why they were successful was because then the FBI had guidelines that required me to have reasonable suspicion to target somebody in a criminal investigation.
And finally, I want to ask you something that's perhaps a little tangential to what we've been talking about, but I know after the FBI, you worked for years with the ACLU, and they just announced a policy, which is that they will no longer be advocating on behalf of free speech activists if those activists are armed. So what do you think of this tension between the First and Second Amendments and how the ACLU's new policy is?
You know, I just briefly read it, but it makes sense. I mean, you know, the idea of making sure we have free speech is so that we can have a broader discussion in the marketplace of ideas, and that your idea will rise or fall based on its merit rather than government suppression. But bringing a gun to a debate makes the ability to counter that debate with reasonable argument much more fraught. So I think that it does make some sense. Again, I would still say they have rights to do that, but, you know, other people have rights to choose whether they want to use their own resources to support that kind of thing. And I think that strikes a reasonable balance.
Mike German, thank you so much. Mike German is a former FBI agent and is currently a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. And we have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, I give you the soapbox.
This week, I can't improve on what my brilliant colleague Kevin Williamson wrote about the Charlottesville Nazis, so I'll just quote some of it. What do the angry white boys want? They want to be someone other than who they are. That's the great irony of identity politics. They seek identity in the tribe because they are failed individuals. They are a chain composed exclusively of weak links. What they're engaged in isn't politics, but theater, play acting in the hopes of achieving catharsis. In the theater, actors and audience both can forget ourselves for an hour or two. Under the soft glow of the tiki torches, these angry white boys can be something else for a night.
Jamil Smith, what's your rant?
I want to focus on sports for a moment. The anthem protests done by Colin Kaepernick and the other players are continuing in this NFL preseason. And Philadelphia Eagles defensive back Malcolm Jenkins, who is black, joined a few other teammates by raising their fists during the anthem before Thursday night's game. And at that moment, Chris Long, their white teammate, put his arm around Jenkins in a show of support. Now, he asked about it afterwards. Long said, quote, "I think it's a good time for people who look like me to be here for people who are fighting for equality. It's a positive sign that a white athlete is finally stepping up as a public ally, but he needs to do more than just be here for his black teammates protesting systemic bigotry. Racism is the white man's burden to solve, so to speak. Don't just support the work, do the work."
Kelly Goff, what's on your mind?
I think the coverage of Charlottesville has reminded us of the power of images, so I want to give a shout-out to one of the most influential magicians of the moving image in American history. Norman Lear depicted the first upper-class black family and first mixed-race family on television in The Jeffersons, and created one of TV's most famous racist characters, Archie Bunker, on All in the Family. Through these characters, he forced America to confront some occasionally ugly truths through laughter. He is the well-deserved recipient of a Kennedy Center honor, but announced he will not attend this year's reception with the current president for obvious reasons. As an American and as a writer, I thank you, Mr. Lear.
And my rant is this. When Steve Bannon gave his interview to Robert Kuttner, he said about North Korea's nuclear threats, "There is no military solution. Forget it until somebody solves the part of the equation that shows me that 10 million people in Seoul didn't die in the first 30 minutes from conventional weapons. I don't know what you're talking about. There's no military solution here." I was heartened. I thought the most unhinged guy in the administration is actually speaking truth about North Korea. Then the guy goes and gets fired. There goes that silver lining. And that's all the time we have for today. Thanks to Rich Lowry, Jamil Smith, Kelly Goff, and Mike German. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Berskins is our production assistant. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I am Mike Petka. Josh Barrow will be back next week. Thank you for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.